This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the Green Party says the 99% will have a candidate in this year's presidential race, whether Bernie Sanders runs as an independent or not. We'll speak with presidential candidate Jill Stein. And prison inmates in Alabama staged a work stoppage at facilities around the state, refusing to take part in a slave labor system.
But first, Dilma Rousseff of the Brazilian Workers' Party was removed from her office as president last week and put on trial by the nation's Senate on charges of manipulating the budget. Rousseff is not accused of any acts of personal corruption, but about 60% of the senators that will be judging her do face corruption charges. Rousseff's Workers' Party says the impeachment proceedings amount to a soft coup, and they will fight it out in the streets. Dr. Gerald Horn is a prolific author and professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston. He says the right-wing move against Rousseff must be understood in a global context.
It's certainly a coup d'etat through so-called parliamentary means, but you have to see it in the context of a larger counteroffensive by the right wing in the Americas. You can say that it started with the coup in Honduras in 2009. You could say that it accelerated with the death of Hugo Chavez, and now with his successor, President Maduro, on the ropes. You can say that it accelerated further with the dislodging of Cristina Kirchner from the leadership of Argentina, and with the loss of the referendum in Bolivia that would have extended the term of President Evo Morales. And this impending removal of Dilma Rousseff has to be seen in that wider context. Now, I think the question we should ask ourselves is how and why it is that the right wing has been able to gain so much strength in the Americas. I think part of it has to do with the slowdown of the global economy. Keep in mind that the rise of the left in the Americas was to a certain extent based upon the Chinese juggernaut, that is to say, China buying up oil from Venezuela and soybeans and agricultural products from Brazil. But with the slowdown in China, that slowed down the economies of the South American nations. And of course, the constant interference of U.S. imperialism certainly has to be factored into the equation. I'm sure you know the old joke about why is it that there is relative political stability in Washington, but not throughout the hemisphere. And of course, the answer is that there's no U.S. embassy in Washington, D.C. And so when you look at what's going on in Brazil, you have to put it into this wider context. But I'm optimistic still about Brazil. That is to say that the Workers' Party has suffered a setback. There's no doubt about that. But already you can see that there is a bit of anger towards the incoming administration of so-called President Temer, who, as you know, has appointed an all-male, all-white cabinet, who was appointed a creationist as Minister of Science and Technology. And so I think that already he's stumbling out of the starting gate, which gives me hope for the future for Brazil.
Well, let's talk about the racial aspect of this. We saw that the demonstrations against Dilma Rousseff seemed to be comprised of folks who were overwhelmingly white in a country that is at least half African descended.
You are correct. And there's little doubt that the Workers' Party had garnered a substantial percentage of the vote in African-derived communities. Because keep in mind that the signature program of the Workers' Party were these transfer programs, whereby the analysis was is that the problem with regard to poverty is that poor people don't have enough money, surprise, surprise, and therefore it's the role of the government to put money into their pockets so that they will have money to buy clothes for their children and food for their children. In fact, programs were constructed to give incentives to parents, material incentives, to parents who made sure that their kids attended school every day. Now, those programs are on the ropes, and as a result, you're going to have a lot of angry working class people, a lot of angry black people in Brazil.
Yes, the Workers' Party government raised about 30% of the population out of poverty, but when those commodity prices, when the bottom fell out of that market, the Workers' Party turned to austerity.
Well, certainly there are a number of criticisms that can be made of the Rousseff regime. I've been reading the press, and there have been criticisms of her leadership style, for example, that she was not friendly enough, that she wasn't adept at building coalitions. We know that the parliament in Brazil has about 24+ parties, and in order to effectuate a winning parliamentary program, you have to build relationships with these diverse parties. And there is a nugget, a kernel of truth in many of those analyses. But as with regard to the United States, I would say with regard to Brazil, that is to say that it would be a mistake to analyze either the United States or Brazil on solely national terms, that you have to look at the global environment, you have to look at the global correlation of forces, and the global correlation of forces, which seemed to be promising from 2011 till about 2014, are not as promising as they were during that earlier period.
And in terms of the long arm of the United States, we of course know that the United States spied on Dilma Rousseff, and she went to the UN General Assembly and denounced the Obama administration for doing that. But they also spied intensely on Petrobras, the state oil company. And many Brazilians suspect that the United States shared what it learned about Petrobras in terms of corruption with the enemies of the Workers' Party.
Well, when you mentioned the state oil company of Brazil, Petrobras, that's another piece of the puzzle. That is to say that about a year ago, oil prices were about $100 a barrel or $110 a barrel. Now, they're about 45. A few weeks ago, they were as low as 30. And that's put a hole not only in the budget of Brazil, but in the budget of Angola and Nigeria and Russia and Venezuela, etc. That's why I'm suggesting that in order to do an analysis of Brazil, you have to look at these mega factors, these global factors. And with there being little prospect as of now of a rise in the price of a barrel of oil, obviously all of those countries I just mentioned are going to have to scramble and come up with a new development strategy based upon a sinking price of oil as opposed to a rising price of oil.
Dilma Rousseff and her Workers' Party say that they will take this battle to the streets, since it's obviously not going to be won in this legislature. What forces will she be mobilizing or attempt to mobilize?
Well, the forces we've just made reference to, poor working-class black folk in the first place. I foresee a plethora of tactics and strategies unleashed in the streets of Brazil. I foresee boycotts. I foresee sit-down strikes. I foresee occupations of key buildings in the capital, Brasilia. I think that during the Olympics, where the global spotlight will be on Brazil, there will be an exhibition by poor working-class black folk to express their disapproval of what's going on in their country.
And what about the military? This new government of Temer, who attracts only the support of about 2% of the population, and because of his own corruption, has been barred from running for office, would seem to lack legitimacy. And one might see the military step into that kind of void.
Well, that is the $64 question. Keep in mind that Brazil has experienced many bitter decades in the 20th century of military rule. But once again, I'm afraid that this is not something that's limited to Brazil. Look at the polls that have just come out in the Military Times in the United States of America, which suggest overwhelming support, particularly in the officer corps, for the presidential candidacy of Donald J. Trump. This is nothing new. The office of core in the United States historically has leaned to the right. This is why, once again, you cannot necessarily rule out not only a soft coup in Brazil, but you cannot rule out machinations by the U.S. office of core in the United States of America.
Shades of that movie and book, 7 Days in May.
I'm afraid so. I mean, I think to a certain extent, I think that many of our friends on the left were sort of living in a fool's paradise. They have all this blather about democracy and all of that, and not analyzing the labor movement, not analyzing the U.S. officer corps, not analyzing regionally states like Mississippi, asking why it is that there is this astonishing cross-class coalition of the poor whites and the rich whites in voting for the same candidate. I mean, we have a lot of questions that we have to answer.
That was Dr. Gerald Horn speaking from Houston, Texas.
Socialist Alternative Party leader Kushama Sawant is circulating a petition asking Bernie Sanders to run as an independent if his campaign for the Democratic presidential nomination is unsuccessful. Sawant says Sanders should either run on the Green Party ticket or pave the way for a new party of the 99%. The Green Party will choose its presidential candidate in August, and the nominee is expected to be Dr. Jill Stein. We asked Dr. Stein, aren't the Greens already a party of the 99%?
Yes, and I think there are several parties of and for the 99%, and the Green Party is sincerely working to build that party. We have the distinct benefit of having fought for national status for quite a while. And it's not a simple thing to be a national party and jump through the hoops that you need to. So the Greens have quite a bit of administrative expertise in running elections. And the other small parties have quite a bit of expertise in fighting the social movement in the street. And I think there's wonderful possibilities here for collaboration. And that collaboration, I think, does very well with a respectful dialogue. And I think that's the name of the game going forward, is to have that dialogue. We try to use our ballot line for and with other parties. We're in discussion right now with Peace and Freedom, for example, on a possible sharing of their ballot line in collaboration with our campaign. We have historically run jointly with various socialist entities, and we are on the ground fighting the battles with many of them. Everything from the Fight for 15 with Socialist Alternative to the climate justice battles, particularly with the ISO. So the collapse we are witnessing of the toxic political establishment and the hostile takeovers, certainly of the Republican Party and the effort to do so in the Democratic Party, creates a historic opening, I think, for the suppressed voices of the 99%. And it's really important that we work together collaboratively and respectfully to bring our best skills and resources to the table so we can do this. We're not going to have a lot of other opportunities going forward before it's too late.
I'm sure people are asking you, have you had contact with the Sanders campaign regarding any potential eventualities after the convention in Philadelphia?
The Green Party has been reaching out to Bernie Sanders since 2011, before our 2012 campaign, looking for ways we might collaborate and would he be interested in running as an independent, et cetera. And Bernie has always, shall we say, declined our invitation for dialogue by not responding to phone calls, to emails, and to snail mail letters. And we have recently reached him again and did so before this campaign as well. But more recently, after he's been targeted by the Democratic establishment for rapid expunging from the record, you know, with the Democrats asking him, would you please be quiet and go home now? You're not making it easier for us. We've reached out again through some staffers who were willing to be conduits for our outreach email and still have not received a response. And it's clear from his public statements that Bernie's not interested, but you can't help but wonder if there might be some potential for change here. These are, you know, extraordinary historic moments right now for civilization and humanity. And it really begs for new thinking and thinking outside of the box. And the beating that Senator Sanders is taking from the Democratic Party, might he think differently in the future? We shall see. I'm not holding my breath. He's been pretty consistent ever since he's been in Washington that he regards third parties as renegades and as a threat to political order and as spoilers, essentially, not recognizing that you really can't spoil something which is already spoiled beyond repair. So he's not been particularly friendly to us in his public statements, but he hasn't been unfriendly either. So we'll see where it goes. At the end of the day, what really counts here is where this movement goes. And I would hope that the movement, Bernie's movement in particular, be true to their values and see things with maybe a clarity of vision that sometimes you don't see after you've been in Washington for decades. So maybe the youthful insight that's part of the DNA of his campaign will remain true to the vision and not be co-opted back into the Hillary Clinton campaign. Exit polls suggest up to 30% have already expressed their refusal ever to go back to predatory politics of the Democratic Party. But that's without most of them having a clue that there is a plan B. In fact, some of Bernie's supporters are calling us plan B plus because we are perhaps more consistently aligned with their vision of democracy and justice worldwide.
Yes, almost everyone expects that the Green Party will be the beneficiary of the disappointment that Bernie's supporters will face in Philadelphia. Is the Green Party structurally up to accommodating the potentially millions of people who want someplace to go when Bernie Sanders is not there?
Exactly. You know, I think the benefit of a political campaign is that it is a more efficient form of organization than a party, but it is also a conduit into a party. So step one would be to offer Bernie's supporters a continuing vehicle for their electoral momentum. But at the same time, it's really critical that we build the party in its many state chapters and local chapters. And I'm glad to say what I've seen over the course of the past year is incredible growth of the local structures of the party. So a lot of new people coming in and a lot of people coming back into the fold who had just sort of felt hopeless. The Green Party, like any non-corporate party, is a very serious threat to the political establishment and the economic elite. So when we talk about the Green Party not being strong, you want to say strong compared to what? Like the Labor Party that was founded at the same time but has essentially been wiped off the map as a functioning entity, or the other socialist and peace and freedom parties who've been able to hang on in the case of peace and freedom in several states. For the socialist parties, it's usually a city here and there. This is not by coincidence. This is not just sort of a matter of, oh, we gave up. You know, this is a matter of very purposeful fear campaigning and smear campaigning against third parties, which we have seen very viciously since the Nader-Bush-Gore days, but, you know, goes way back before that, certainly to McCarthy era and so on. When ballot access rules were changed to steeply tilt the playing field, the media, as it's been further corporatized, systematically locks out and shuts out dissident voices. And there is sabotage. There's abundant sabotage out there. And it's not by chance that it has been such a deep struggle for political opposition to remain alive. So from that point of view, in my understanding, the Green Party and all the other, you know, small parties of resistance, but in particular the Greens, because we have managed to just hang on by the skin of our teeth nationwide. So now that the House of Cards is falling down, now is the time for us to redouble our efforts and recognize the forces that have been arrayed against us and push ahead. Now that we're needed, with great gratitude to those who've managed to persevere, to now piggyback on their efforts and build the new vehicle that we need going forward. I could say a word more about the collaboration among small parties, if that's of interest.
Well, yes. What kind of collaboration has been going on, and what's planned for between now and the convention?
Last year, last summer, the Left Elect Conference in Chicago in June, it included many of the small parties of the left. Bruce was there, that is Bruce Dixon, and it was just a whole new ballgame among small parties in which sectarianism, I have to say, was nowhere to be seen, and people were not identifying each other by their party label. We just knew each other from the street battles we had shared. And I think that's kind of what changed, that our work in the street has become so consuming and fighting the battles of environmental racism and climate justice in particular has brought lots of groups together in very bonding ways. Getting arrested together or risking arrest is quite a bonding experience. And a lot more of that is going on than used to be the case. And I think collaboration around Black Lives Matter and the student debt struggle, you know, there's just been a number of very unifying struggles that have brought us together across movement lines, across racial and cultural lines, and the immigrant justice, and particularly the fight for indigenous rights and sovereignty, have been very instructive and unifying struggles. And I think that has worn off on the sectarian left that has managed to get past that. And we're off to a really good start. So this Left Elect thing has a board which has continued to meet. And we will be holding another convention in June. There will be workshops at the Left Forum. So it is an ongoing, living, breathing entity that continues to build collaboration and trust. So I would really look to that as a framework we can build on. And the Green Party continues to offer its ballot line and its electoral expertise to the other small parties of the left. And that's been a very fruitful collaboration. Sometimes the question comes up, what will our name be? And to tell you the truth, people aren't worried about that, in my experience. At least most aren't debating the name. We're sort of working with a sense of community and the kind of the institutional structures that we've managed to build and focusing on that as our first priority, with the understanding that at some point we may discuss the name and consider whether there might be a point to tweaking the name. But I'm glad to say there's a political maturity here so that people are not making this a turf battle for the most part inside of this broader coalition of the Left Elect. And we're putting first principles first.
The Green Party is going to have a presence at the Philadelphia Convention, presumably to make direct contact with the Sanders people there.
That's right. And the torch here really is being carried by the Sanders people, who've sort of been nudging us all along, that is, nudging my campaign. Many of our supporters are Bernie supporters. Some are not, but many are. And many have looked to our campaign for quite some time to be their plan B. And they are the ones who are reaching out to their fellow Sandinistas to get the word out about us. So, you know, we plan to have facilities and events to welcome people if they find that the events at the Democratic Convention have, in fact, led to burnout, then there may be a transition in the works that we will be ready for. And we will be hosting some kind of an event. We're still looking at dealing with permitting. There will be a very important gathering and march called the March for Our Lives, which takes place every 4 years at these conventions, that the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign has been very active in organizing over many years, and they plan to do so again. We will be participating and supporting those efforts and intend for the Democratic Convention to be once more a lifting up of the people's agenda and the people's resistance and the frontline communities who are leading that charge. We will conduct a parallel program to provide a political voice for that social movement that deserves to be front and center of presidential dialogue.
Hillary Clinton appears to be already in the midst of a strategy to create a big tent Democratic Party, scooping up these Republican refugees from Trump. Won't that create an environment, a political environment, that is even more inhospitable to progressives in the Democratic Party?
Exactly. And I think by reaching out, as Hillary is doing, to Republican voters, and you know, in particular, she's going after Republican women who may be off-put by Mr. Trump's agenda. She's reaching out to Republican women. She's also particularly reaching out to donors, to Jeb Bush, for example. So what does this say about her agenda and her flip-flopping faster than the eye can see, even in the course of one debate on minimum wages? You know, first she's for 15, then she's not for 15, and we've seen Hillary flip-flop on everything except her stance on the war. She's a pretty solid and consistent warmonger. There's no doubt about that. Looking to establish a no-fly zone over Syria, which amounts to basically a declaration of war with another nuclear-armed power, the Russians. But aside from her stance on all things military, which Hillary are we talking about? Is it the Goldwater girl of the 50s? Is it the new Democrat of the 60s and 70s, which sort of surged to the right to keep pace with Ronald Reagan? Or is it the Hillary that's reaching out to the African-American community, stressing her alleged track record for social justice, which I might add bears a close examination? Because while Hillary may be great at proposing equal wage bills, look what Hillary did to wages for poor women in Haiti, where as Secretary of State, she helped lead the charge to roll back a minimum wage increase in Haiti that went from 24 cents an hour to 60 cents an hour under pressure from American corporations represented by a Secretary of State. That minimum wage increase was rolled back from 60 cents an hour back to like 40 cents an hour. And likewise, taking great credit for the Children's Health Insurance Plan, which Hillary advocated for as First Lady, then she would also need to take credit for the consequences of the Wall Street deregulation that led to 6 million families losing their home, 9 million losing their jobs. And she would also have to take credit for the NAFTA, which I believe Hillary has been all out on trade agreements. But there she would need to take credit for the millions of jobs that have been lost and the wages that have been pushed downward on account of NAFTA. So there are many Hillarys. And historically, they've mostly not been friendly to the 99%. So Hillary's explicit appeal now to Republicans ought to be speaking volumes to her supporters, her allegedly progressive supporters. And this just continues to build this perfect storm for political transformation, which is begging to happen. In order to fix our rigged economy, we must also fix our rigged political system. And launching an independent third party on the base of the Green Party, which is there, hard won, let's not discard that progress. Building on that progress now that this window of opportunity has opened in our lifetimes, who would have thought? This is the time to forget the lesser evil and fight for the greater good, like our lives depend on it, because they do.
In the interest of that greater good, you're running under a Power to the People plan, and one of the main points of that plan is your Green New Deal, which you've been pushing for, since the last presidential election season.
Exactly, yes. A Green New Deal whose time has really come. The Green New Deal declares a state of emergency, an economic emergency, because the recovery has been for the few at the top. Most people are struggling still with part-time and temporary jobs, if they're lucky enough to have one, and poverty-level wages, as well as epic levels of student loan debt. So we have an economic emergency, and we have a climate emergency. And all of those emergencies are greatest in the communities of color, who are the preeminent victims of climate racism and environmental racism, as well as economic racism and injustice. So here we have converging the scourges of our time. And the Green New Deal is an incredible transformational program, which is as big as the crisis barreling down on us. It calls for the emergency creation of 20 million good wage jobs, full-time jobs, that focus on greening our energy, our food, our transportation, and restoring other critical infrastructure as defined by communities at the local level. And that includes restoring ecosystems like our water systems, our sheds, our coastlines, our fisheries, our land, our forests, et cetera, whose welfare, you know, we depend on as well. So it's a broad program. It's federally funded, but locally controlled, so that the funding is largely defined by communities, goes to the communities with greatest need first, and those communities within the general guidelines of the program can decide how they use it. It's intended to jumpstart jobs through small businesses, that is not large corporations, not multinationals, these are small local businesses, and worker cooperatives and community cooperatives, so it creates a diversified economic structure. And it attempts to reach 100% clean, healthy, community-friendly, and community-controlled renewable energy by 2030. So it's truly an emergency program with a very rapid implementation. This can be done when Pearl Harbor was bombed at the outset of the U.S. role in the Second World War. It took us 6 months to gear up the U.S. economy from 0% on a wartime footing to 25% of GDP within 6 months. So there is no doubt that we can do this in 15 years. We can completely transition to wind, water, and sun, and that means zero fossil fuels and zero nuclear energy. And this begins with an emergency ban on all new fossil fuel and nuclear infrastructure, beginning the day that we turn the White House into a greenhouse.
Your Power to the People plan calls for jobs as a right, health care as a right, education as a right. Sounds at least as socialist as Bernie Sanders. Some smart people like Paul Street have suggested that you guys ought to have socialism somewhere in your platform, if not in your name.
Yes, this is very true. Let me first just also add to that platform, student debt abolition. We are the only campaign, and we'll be the only choice on the ballot that will cancel student debt. And I want to give this great emphasis because this is our secret weapon for actually self-mobilizing, because there are 43 million young people and not so young people who are locked into student debt. 43 million is a plurality, a winning plurality of the presidential vote in a typical campaign. But if you add to that a supportive family member, that 43 million becomes 86 million, and that is a winning majority of a vote, even in a two-way race. So this is a constituency that is capable of self-mobilizing through social media and spreading the word. And it doesn't take a lot of convincing, believe me, to encourage people to come out and spend an hour checking the green box on the ballot to basically cancel their $35,000 average student loan debt. This is something that is largely in the hands of a president, not requiring an act of Congress, because it's the Federal Reserve, whose chair the president appoints, that decides when to do a quantitative easing. This is a quantitative easing, which is basically a financial hat trick that essentially digitally cancels debt that the government buys up and basically cancels. And in fact, the government is the owner of most student debt already. So the government can cancel that debt. This is what we did for Wall Street, the crooks who crashed the economy through their waste, fraud, and abuse. cost us about $4 trillion in quantitative easing. Isn't it time we did so for the victims of the crooks on Wall Street? And one last point to mention here, which is that this is a stimulus package, unlike the bailout for Wall Street, which basically brought us more of the same, more reckless gambling at taxpayer peril. The student bailout essentially unleashes enormous productivity into the economy. It releases young people from debt servitude and working low-wage corporate jobs, preparing fast food or in retail sales, and enables them to actually do meaningful work in the areas that they love. And this is how we reimagine the future, as each generation must do. So this is a benefit not just to young people, but to all of us who rely on the young folks out there to lead the way for social transformation, as they already are doing in Black Lives Matter, in fighting sweatshops, in immigrant rights. The climate justice movement, it's always the younger generation, but so many of them are doing this with one or two hands tied behind their back. They need to be fully liberated. On the question of where does the word socialism fit in here, and what I usually say when asked, you know, it's funny, the socialists, people who are members of the Socialist Party tend to be people who really understand their history, and Greens tend to be people who are really mobilized in the moment and are learning their history as they go. And I would say I'm one of those people. You know, I've been a science wonk for most of my life and was sort of dragged kicking and screaming into political activism when I discovered that all the science in the world wasn't going to do it for us. So there may be differences in terminology, but I don't think there are differences in agenda. And when people, you know, am I a socialist? What I usually say is, because I talk to so many people who don't understand the isms of any sort, so I usually try to get to the meaning of it. So I say, well, if by socialism you mean economic democracy and you mean an economy in which the people who are impacted define the system and have power in that system, and if you mean an economy that abides by the golden rule as opposed to a system of cutthroat competition and the religion of greed, then yes, call it socialism and bring it on.
On foreign policy, you've promised to conduct a policy that's based on diplomacy and international law and human rights. What a novel idea for the United States.
Yes, and we can see how well the alternative to that is working out. We have a foreign policy based on economic and military domination, and it's proving to be rather problematic. Since 9/11, we have spent, by some estimates, $6 trillion, or it will amount to $6 trillion by the time we've paid for the health care and the chronic care of war veterans. That $6 trillion, by the way, is $75,000 per household on average that will have been contributed to this war effort. 1 million people have been killed in Iraq alone, not winning us hearts and minds in the Middle East, to say the least, and tens of thousands of U.S. soldiers already have been killed or maimed. And what do we have to show for that? We have failed states. We have mass refugee migrations, which are further tearing apart the Middle East and Europe. And we have worse terrorist threats. And if I can comment on that for a moment, because with one hand, we are fighting terrorism, but with the other hand, we and our allies from the very start have been arming, funding, and training jihadi terror. And so what is meant by that? Well, you can go back to the origins of jihadi terror in Afghanistan with the creation of the Mujahideen. And it was the CIA together with the Saudis that came up with this great plan for bringing jihadists from all over the world into Afghanistan to fight. And it was around that time that the Saudis also established their madrasas, which became these schools for recruiting and training young jihadists from around the world. And that campaign in Afghanistan then became the basis from which Al-Qaeda was launched. Osama bin Laden himself was trained, in fact, in this process. And in addition to that, the Taliban was made a far greater and more ferocious force. And from there, out of the chaos of Iraq, we created ISIS. So at each turn of the cycle of violence, the terror threat has become only worse. And even as late as 2009, a memo from the State Department by Hillary Clinton herself that was subsequently leaked identified the Saudis as still the major funder of terrorism worldwide. And the U.S. recently sold almost $100 billion worth of weapons to the Saudis. We ourselves have been in supply efforts to the so-called good terrorists, but of course terrorists are not card-carrying members of organizations. They are constantly shape-shifting and morphing and include genuine resistance fighters as well as warlords, as well as religious extremists. So you don't particularly want to be hanging your hat with them, yet this has been the U.S. game plan for a long time. Basically, recruit the warlord du jour, and that's now become recruit the terrorist du jour. And they're here today, and tomorrow they've crossed over. So, you know, this has been a disastrous policy. The U.S. is supplying the majority of weapons worldwide, and we, of course, are supporting the majority to the Middle East, where arms are getting into the hands of everybody. So therein lies the potential for a solution, because more of a catastrophically failed game plan is not such a good idea. What didn't we throw into the effort, you know, in Afghanistan and in Iraq? There was no stone left unturned to win that battle. Yet now we're about to implement the same battle plan. This is like ludicrous. This doesn't pass the laugh test. And it can only stand up as long as the opposition is silent and the criticism is silent. And unfortunately, that's what all the Democratic and Republican players sign up to. You don't criticize that plan. And even Bernie Sanders departs from Hillary Clinton only in saying that it ought to be the Saudis who do this. The Saudis should do our dirty work. Well, unfortunately, the Saudis already are doing our dirty work. And this is the problem. It's not the solution. So we really need to break with that plan. Fortunately, because we have been the major driver of this chaos, it gives us incredible power to actually shut it down. And how do we do that? It's not just by walking away, because to simply walk away officially leaves the weapons industry in charge. It means creating a weapons embargo to the Middle East, which we can begin because we're supplying most of the weapons, but we need to bring the Russians in on this too and build on our newly developed relationship with Iran and so on, as well as our relationship with our current allies among the Gulf states. You know, we need to use our influence for the greater good here instead of on behalf of the weapons industry, who is the only one that is benefiting from this plan, which is basically death and destruction to everyone, which comes back to haunt us Westerners as well in the blowback, the terrorist blowback. So everybody is imperiled by what is essentially a marketing strategy. Our foreign policy is a marketing strategy for the weapons industry, and it's time to shut that down. We need a weapons embargo to the Middle East. We need to put our friends and allies on notice that we are going to shut down the bank accounts and freeze them of our friends and allies who continue to fund jihad groups, and we need to work with our friends in Turkey. We did so to shut down the border to the movement of immigrants, regrettably, but if they did that, we can get them to shut down their border to the movement of jihadi militias. So we can basically cut ISIS off at the pass. Bombing ISIS is only going to create the next version of it. We need to deprive ISIS of its food and water, essentially, and stop ISIS in its tracks by shutting down the entire apparatus of these wars for oil, which we have the potential to do.
Dr. Jill Stein, the expected presidential candidate of the Green Party.
A statewide work stoppage by inmates at Alabama prisons seems to be winding down. The protest was organized by inmates of the Free Alabama Movement. Pastor Kenneth Glasgow has been negotiating on behalf of the prisoners. Glasgow has himself served a term in prison. He is now head of a prison reform group called TOPS, which stands for the Ordinary People Society. Glasgow is the half-brother of Reverend Al Sharpton. Pastor Glasgow talked to us about the prisoners' grievances.
Their main complaints are the inhumane treatment that they were receiving. They were getting bird fed, meaning that they were getting real, real low portions of food. because of the peaceful strike. And some of the things that they're saying that they complain about mostly is the inhumane conditions also of the prison. There's mildew everywhere. The overcrowding is extremely high to where, you know, you put your hand out and be touching another person that's right there. I mean, it's just crazy what's going on with the overcrowding. It's hard for them to get fed on time. You know, anytime there's an overcrowded condition, it puts excess on everything else. So that's exactly what's going on. The other thing that's going on there, there's no grievance procedure there. So there's no way to hold accountability or transparency if you don't have a grievance procedure. The things that they're talking about in their demands is life without parole. There's also the Habitual Offender Act that's going on where you got about 8,000 prisoners that's in there that should be out, but that would because of low-level drug crimes or low-level property crimes. They're also looking at the drive-by shooting, which is really disparaging, which leads us to another area, which is a disparity in the state of Alabama, period, that goes beyond the prison and into the judge's hands and the prosecutor. You know, when you look at sentencing, when you look at bonds, when you look at arrest, the disparaging numbers are alarming, man. I mean, they're locking up black folks like 15 to 1 compared to white people. There's no rehabilitation, education, or reentry preparedness going on. These are mainly the things that they talk about. The 17 cent an hour that they're receiving for working inside the prison. When I met with the commissioner today, I asked him about that. He said that that wasn't totally up to them at the Department of Corrections. It relies on the legislators in those industries that came in. However, those that work in the kitchen and the laundry do not get paid. So I asked, what about incentives? Meaning them getting good time or gain time or something like that. He said that they do get that just for basic good behavior without them working or anything. So there's no incentive, but they just work because they want to work. Those are the complaints. The biggest thing that I really want to point out there that really got to me is the fact that while they're in prison, they're having to pay for it. They have to pay when they get a disciplinary report for the administration, $4. If they get caught with a cell phone, $25. They get caught the second time, $50. The third time, $25 more, which is $75. And have to pay their co-pay for medical. You know, so that really makes me feel like people are getting double taxed, so to speak. What I mean by that is that taxpayers are already paying for people to be incarcerated. People that are supporters or family of those people who are incarcerated are sending money to those who are incarcerated to buy compensatory food and snacks and stuff like that because they're not getting enough to be fed. But then that money is not going toward their compensatory. They're being charged by the prisons for everything that's being provided, as well as taxpayers providing the prison and the prison system with money to take care of all the things. Those are the reasons. So I'm appealing, I'm asking, I'm begging, I'm really calling out to all the churches, all the labor unions, all the organizations that really say you're about a mass incarceration, you're about doing work to help people that are incarcerated, you're about helping those that are directly impacted. I am appealing to all of them that we need help.
The plan was for these work stoppages to last at least 30 days. What kind of tactics has the prison administration been using to get inmates to go back to work in addition to feeding them small portions of food?
In addition to the bird feeding, what we call it, they have also done some very undermining tactics by using those that are work release inmates. They have got other inmates from work release to come in and do the jobs that the inmates inside the prisons would normally be doing. So that clearly undermines and really, really just changed the dynamics of the prison strike as well.
Based on your negotiations and observations, which among the demands, which begin with the end of prison slavery, that is the low or no pay for work, which of these demands does it look like the administration might give in on?
They agreed to give in on the rehabilitation, the education, and the reentry. They agreed to that one already. So that's something that we're working on. As far as the parole board, the Senate Bill 67 that just passed and went into effect February 1st, that is already implemented on one half, and that is that the parole board, for the first time in history in Alabama, will be given an explanation on why they denied somebody, if they denied somebody, and not putting them off for 5 or 6 years, but only 2 years, 1 year normally and 2 years of severe cases. Those are two that has already been addressed and agreed upon. The rest of them we're definitely going to have to work upon, and also a fact-finding mission. They agreed upon me going into the prison to visit some of these brothers, especially the leaders. They have agreed upon that.
Pastor Kenneth Glasgow, speaking from Alabama. Inside the prison walls, the work stoppage was organized by inmate activists like Bennu Hannibal, a leader of the Free Alabama Movement. Hannibal spoke to prison radio from the St. Clair Correctional Facility.
Free Alabama Movement is organizing on the inside of the prisons. We're organizing the labor. We're organizing the institutional labor, which means the kitchens, the maintenance crews, the laundry workers, the lawn workers, and we're also organizing the industry workers, which work in the factories that are producing the products for state agencies and private corporations that are generating hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars. And these dollars are being used to finance our own incarceration. Here in the Free Alabama Movement, we have been organizing work strikes since January the 1st of 2014. We also use social media in our struggle. We encourage brothers and sisters who have access to cell phones, video recorders, to use those recorders and use those devices to project the true images about what's actually going on inside of these prison systems. We have solitary confinement, general population, the cruel and inhumane living conditions, the inadequate space, the filth, the rodents, anything that you see that will help shed light on the truth about what incarceration is really like in America, the epidemic of overcrowding and mass incarceration for prison slavery, human trafficking, and human warehousing that is going on right now. We encourage you to take an active role in getting this message out. We're in the process of organizing nationally. We're like to organize with our brothers and sisters from around the country. We already have a Free Mississippi Movement. There's a Free California Movement. There's a Free Pennsylvania Movement. There are other movements that are organizing around the country, and we're asking everyone to participate because the system is organized. All of these corporations are organized. The politicians are organized around the country. The companies that have the political action committees, these people are all organized, and the only way that we're going to have an impact against them is if we organize in a likewise manner. We have been seeing resistance going on from California, the hunger strikes, the work strikes, Georgia, the work strikes, the historic work strikes, the hunger strikes in Washington and Texas, the resistance out of Texas at the immigration facilities, Nebraska, Arizona. We see all this resistance, and we want to bring it all together. We work off a platform called the Six-Step Program. One of the things that we emphasize is drafting what we call a Freedom Bill. You can find a copy of our Freedom Bill on our website, which is www.freealabamamovement.com. And we encourage everyone to draft a Freedom Bill in your state for your freedom movement that addresses the particular legislation that is being used to perpetuate mass incarceration. Alabama has the most overcrowded prison system in the country, and within our Freedom Bill, the first provision calls for an immediate reduction down to the design capacity of the prison. We also call for reforms to the parole boards and other avenues of education and rehabilitation that will help return people back to society and prepare to be productive members of society. So we encourage everyone, if you want to reach out to Free Alabama Movement, you can reach us at freealabamamovement@gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook. We're on Twitter. We have a blog, freealabamamovement.wordpress.com. And we're anywhere and everywhere you can find us on social media. And we want to connect with our brothers and sisters behind the fence because we have to organize. This is our movement, and this is our struggle. In summation, I just want to say for the family members and supporters and people on the outside who are supporting the struggle, supporting the movement against mass incarceration, we ask that you all help us bring this struggle to the prisons. We're not calling for protests at capitals. We don't want marches in downtown Madison Square. We want to create a critical mass of protesters at the prisons. We want to create protests to send that energy on the inside, to let the brothers know, the sisters know, there is a support group and network out there, and to also send the message that we must organize this labor if we must attack the economic system. It's no longer a political system. It's an economic system of mass incarceration for prison slavery. And we certainly invite anyone who is interested in organizing a freedom movement charter in your state to please contact Free Alabama Movement. Reach out to us. Our phone number is area code 256-384-4326. Again, that's 256-384-4326. From the struggle here in Alabama, Free Alabama Movement. My name is Benu Hannibal. Peace, love, struggle.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.